you don't have to do things the way people tell you to do them. You don't have to like engage with dialogues on the terms that are presented to you if you choose not to. If you can change the terms of the dialogue, then you can change the potential outcomes.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Co-Free Coffee Cast. I'm your host Sandy McGuire, and this week I had the pleasure of sitting down with Solomon Bothwell. I met Solomon on the Functional Programming Slack, where I noticed this person who kept asking really good questions, and subsequently seemed to be learning Haskell faster than anyone else I've ever met. These days, Solomon is a professional Haskell programmer, but in past lives has been a carpenter, radio station operator, and organized a free school. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Solomon. I guess we'll just dive in here, and my first question for you is that you started a community radio station. Like, what the hell does that even mean? How do you start a radio station? Can you tell me about that experience?
So, when I was in college, I went to UC Davis, and they have a really amazing college station called KDVS, and it was completely run by students, and it was a free-form station where you can do whatever you want on your show as long as you put in a certain number of station IDs per hour. And it was just like a really awesome community to be a part of. And it was really sort of formative to my college experience. And then when I moved back down to LA where I grew up, I sought out something similar and didn't really find what I was looking for in the college stations that are here. And I ended up, you know, getting kind of really frustrated with the college stations and the public radio stations like NPR, and kind of just started telling people that I was going to start my own radio station. This was about 10 years ago. And I just started telling my friends that I was starting a radio station. And every time I told someone that, they got really interested and would ask me what I meant by that and would ask for more details. And I just kind of kept having to like backfill in more details, even though I wasn't really doing any work on it. It was just like a rant that I had. And like, and then eventually like one friend of mine, he is like this really incredible graphic designer, and he really loved the idea. And so he just started sending me emails with all of this like design work for it. And like, that was like really impactful. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's like putting all this work into making design work for this thing that doesn't even exist. And I'm not even doing any work on it. And that like almost got me to work on it, but it wasn't quite enough. I was still really lazy. So, and then I told another friend of mine who was a musician, and he was like, whoa, this is a cool idea. I think we should really do this. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And he was like, no, I mean, just tell me yes, and I'll email like every musician in LA, and we can organize an event and like have people come and do radio shows and like do like a one-off broadcast. And I was like, whoa, that's a great idea. And then I said yes, and then I actually had to follow through on it. And I kind of had like, I already knew what I needed to do at that point because I had been kind of making it up for a while. But basically, I bought like a little kit transmitter that I put together for like low power AM broadcast. And we borrowed a bunch of like radio and DJ equipment. And we did it in the storefront of this, this free school that I was working at and, or volunteering at or organizing or whatever. And, we just like had people come on and do a little like 15-minute broadcast where they would do like a mini version of some sort of radio show. Like, maybe they played music, or they did an interview, or they gave relationship advice, or whatever it was. There was a bunch of different shows. It was like a whole afternoon. It was really fun. And everyone would listen just in the alleyway outside of the storefront, where we had some radios set up so you could hear it through the radio. And everyone loved it so much that we just kind of like scheduled more events like that. And then eventually we we did like a weekly broadcast from my friend Luke's, the guy who helped me send out the email, like from his art studio. And then one nightly broadcast turned into two nightly broadcasts, turned into like a week of nightly broadcasts. And eventually it was like over 100 people involved, and we like rented out a big space and like started doing events with like museums and galleries and stuff, and like bringing in other organizations to do things. And like, it just kind of like, and now it's a actual 501c3 nonprofit, and it's been around for 10 years. And oh yeah, and then the thing I forgot to mention was the way that it is able to work is that there's a carve out in the FCC regulations for unlicensed broadcast, and it's highly restrictive on what you can do with AM and FM, with the AM and FM broadcast bands. But essentially, if you sort of comply with that, with their, you know, highly constrained technical requirements, then you can broadcast, and you're limited on AM, if you have like kind of an optimal setup given the constraints, you can transmit about half a kilometer, which is not significant, but it's kind of like, it's fine. It's supposed to be like a hyper local thing, and it's just for fun, and we record everything and put recordings online. And well, I mean, I'm not involved anymore, but there's a whole archive online, and it's pretty amazing. There's like 10 years of recordings just archived online.
I was sort of wondering if it was some sort of pirate broadcast.
There's a lot of these different kinds of carve-outs in terms of like the RF spectrum and for your experimental operations on different frequency bands, and even, and then all, obviously there's like the ham radio, amateur radio bands. Basically, the reason for all of this is that if you go and look historically at the development of radio and the development of, well, really like all electronics and, you know, computer technology as well, it's sort of like, you know, pre-World War II, say, it was all sort of driven by sort of kind of experimental tinkerers in their garages, if you will. And I mean, there's obviously exceptions, but like that was a huge part of it. And so there, like major, like sort of groundbreaking work in like sort of developing like, you know, AM and FM broadcast comes from like individuals. And so like the FCC is kind of like carved out room for experimental work today, even though now most research is done, you know, at a very high level by like well-funded like corporations or, you know, universities or things. It's still encoded into the regulatory framework to allow for experimental practices.
That is nice to hear. I feel like a lot of people in our circles blame a lot of problems on regulation, and it's nice to know that at least there are some areas carved out for tinkering and experimenting. Something I don't understand about the world is sort of how to organize people to do big projects. And I imagine a radio station is quite a big project. So how do you go about like corralling people into big projects, and what does that look like?
I'm definitely not like an expert on people or anything like that, but I have had some successful projects that involve lots of people. And I guess I would say the secret is, at least what I think is the secret, is to create a project that people want, kind of like define the project or come up with a project that is actually something that people wanted, but they didn't even realize that they wanted to begin with. Like if you can tap into some sort of like desire amongst a group of people where they don't even necessarily know that they have that desire, then suddenly, you know, they're going to want it and they're going to want to be a part of it. And then the community will just kind of happen. Like you don't really need to do any work.
To follow up on that, at the radio station, you had an unusual policy, which was that people could give themselves whatever job title they wanted.
Oh yeah. So initially I ran the whole station and I did essentially all of the work, but I kind of reached like a tipping point where I was really burnt out on it, and I couldn't really handle doing everything as more and more people got more involved in having shows. It was just too much work for me. I sent out an email and I said, hey everybody, I'm really burnt out and we need to sort of change the way that the station is run. I don't really care who does what. As long as people do everything, then it's fine. And if not, then I'm shutting the whole thing down and we can have a meeting to talk about it. And so like we had this meeting and I just basically, I described the way a college radio station is organized from my experience with KDVS, and sort of outlined what the different types of roles are and responsibilities that people generally like need to accomplish in order to have a functioning radio station. And then I told everyone, like, I don't care if you take these titles or like you do this or that or the other thing. I mean, really, you can just do whatever you want. But as long as you do something, then you can have complete autonomy to do it. And so essentially everyone just got to pick like a title that they wanted, and they just picked what tasks they wanted to do. As long as they were actually following through on doing it, then they could have like the final say. And for whatever reason, it just totally worked. Like, some people were like, oh, I want to organize events. And so they became like the station event managers and like scheduled all of our like official events. And then other people were like, oh, I want to like organize like the recording archive. And like, they started like reaching out to labels and getting like recordings and records and stuff. And like, other people were like, oh, I really want to like take care of the space. And like, they sort of like started to like we did this whole like residency thing where they would like invite artists to come in and redecorate the studio. And like, if you just give people the space to like do something and have a sense of ownership over it, and it's already something that they want to be a part of, then it can happen. You have to be willing to let people do things their own way, and that means that like the overall project is not really under your control anymore. And like, the vision for it has to be sort of adaptable, but like, that's the whole point. Like, if you want to have a community, then the community needs to have ownership. And I think a lot of times when people like struggle to have like community involvement in their projects, it's because they don't want to give the project to the community. They just want to sort of have people involved in their thing and still have sort of some control over it. And I think that's where the problem starts.
I really feel that in my professional life. It's hard to get people involved. And I think a lot of it is maybe that unwillingness to give up total control. And I find that especially sort of functional programmers, we quite like a lot of control. And I think it probably is how we got into the field in the first place. Were you like sort of surprised? Did anyone go above and beyond what you had imagined the radio station could be like?
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's really amazing. Like, to go back a little bit, like, my title was station manager. That was like the one position where I said there needs to be someone who is like the station manager. And I said I would do it for like the first year, but that after that it has to like rotate every year. And I just didn't describe how we would pick new people for it. It just was kind of left vague. And so that was like my position for that first year. And like, that was still, so that meant I still had like a lot of responsibility with sort of like coordinating everyone. But like, as soon as I stopped being the station manager, there was immediately someone else took over, and she just completely took responsibility for it. And like, it's a big project. I mean, it was like over 100 people involved. Lily, she just did it for like the next year and was like, or maybe she might have even done it for a couple of years. It was pretty awesome to see people like totally take it seriously, like a real job almost. It was pretty amazing.
How does someone sort of just jump into the job of being a station manager? Had she been an understudy to you, or did she just have a good sense of what needed to be done, or was it not that hard of a job in the first place?
No, it's definitely a hard job to do, but I definitely didn't need to tell her how to do it. It was sort of like, well, she had experience previously with like organizing at her college radio station, and then also with organizing like music venues and shows at music venues, and was just a very well organized, put together person.
I see. So she was like already a good fit for the position. It wasn't sort of diving in head first.
Yeah, totally. And for the most part, whenever someone would take a title or a job or whatever at the radio station, the reason why they would take that job was because it related to something that they were interested in or that they had experience with. There was no rules about who could do what job, and instead it was just sort of like, just through like the power of attraction, like the jobs were like enticing to the people who were like wanted to do those types of things and had relevant experience.
I can imagine there might be jobs that need to get done but aren't that fun and like might not attract anybody. Did you have any situations like that, and if so, how did you overcome them?
Yeah, that was mostly the stuff I ended up doing. the thing that was like the least exciting job would probably be, I forget what we called it, but there was essentially like a kind of like a studio tech person who had to be there every night. And they would like sort of like manage the levels and like the recording and like the sort of like shifting between shows every hour. That was that's definitely like the hardest job to do, and you had to be there like every week for your time slot to do that, or else there was problems. And the way we motivated people, that was like the one thing where it wasn't like the most desirable job to do, but once people were doing it, they found that they really liked it and got into it, and everyone who did it ended up doing it for like really extended periods of time, like years in some cases, because you get develop these relationships with all the people that are doing the shows on that night, and it becomes this sort of like, you know, you're like, oh, it's Thursday night, I get to go hang out with so-and-so for 5 hours. Well, not one person for 5 hours, but you're there for like 3 or 4 or 5 hours, and you're like having different people come on, and it's like you get to check in with them, and it's kind of fun once you get into it. But like the other way we would motivate it was just that like there was a huge wait list to get shows, and if you were one of these techs, then you would short circuit the wait list and you would immediately get to have a show.
That's very clever.
Yeah.
You've previously described your MO as doing the least amount of work to get people collaborating. Can you speak to what that means? What does it look like, and what sort of things has it brought about?
There's this one episode of that TV show Futurama. I don't know if anyone hasn't seen that show. It's like, it's just a cartoon from Matt Groening, but like one of the characters is this robot, and there's an episode where he's like lands into some sort of like nebula or something where there's like a higher being that is like effectively God to Bender, and he gets sage advice from him. And one of the things that the God character says is like, if you do things right, it looks like you didn't do anything at all. And I was like thinking about how like it's funny because like if you do things right, then it doesn't look like you did anything at all. But also if you do things wrong, it looks like you didn't do anything at all. So like, I don't know. I mean, I think like, because like, you know, you, I don't know, like, I just thought that was funny. But I think like when you, it's kind of like in programming, it's the same thing. Like if you get like the right abstraction for what you're implementing, then the solution kind of falls out very naturally. And if you don't, then you end up like over-engineering your solution, and it becomes very convoluted and complicated and ends up being more work. And I think that applies to social situations and like group projects and things like that as well. Like if you're like trying too hard, then it's gonna show, and it's gonna stress you out, and it's gonna stress other people out, and it's like it just doesn't work. Like you have to, I mean, obviously you have to do the amount of work that you have to do to get the thing done, but like I just think in my experience, if you can sort of like minimize if you can just find that sort of like lowest amount of like work that you need to do to like get things moving, then, you know, things can start to fall into place on their own more naturally, and you're not sort of like stuck trying to control the situation.
What do you get personally out of creating space for collaboration?
I'm just a social person, I guess. It's funny because I can spend really extended periods of time by myself. You know, I work remotely. I don't even get out of my house that much these days. And, you know, I'm in similar respects, you know, I'm an introvert. Like I don't like going to parties and like doing things like that. But I really like having a sort of like community of people that I can like lean on and like be a part of. And I've always been that way. And like when I was younger, I used to live in like co-op houses with like groups of people, and like, you know, I've been involved in like, you know, like organizing these different group projects and stuff. And I don't know, it's always just been like kind of comforting to me, I guess. And like I guess in some sense I kind of have like utopian fantasies about different ways of being in the world that are not so adversarial. And I don't know how realistic it is to have any of that stuff play out on a larger scale, but at least like in my personal life and in my personal like social relationships, I can sort of try to experiment with these things.
Something about your communities is really special. And I'm wondering if you think that sort of free collaboration spaces like these can ever compete with the world, you know, the way that things are. Do you think your approach would work on like a much bigger scale?
The word compete is maybe like the wrong way to frame it, I don't think it makes sense to try to, you know, you can't really compete with the world, because no matter what, you're a part of it, you know, you're involved in it, you're responsible for the whole thing. And there's the idea that you can like even be, in order to compete with it, you'd have to be outside of it, and that's not possible. So it's, you know, maybe I would reframe it and say, like, is there a way to sort of like, you know, be a part of the world given the way it is and live like a sort of ethical, engaged, and community-driven lifestyle? And is it possible to make that happen on a large scale? And I would say that anything's possible, but the rules of the game that I've laid out, I don't think it's something that can be sort of implemented top down. It's more of just a way to sort of engage with the people around you. And if everyone started doing that, then there could be some sort of cascading transition that could have larger impacts. But I don't think you can just say, we're going to restructure society in this way and it's going to be utopia. Like, many people have tried that, and I don't think that works.
You're right. Utopia does seem to be quite a hard thing to get, especially top down. And I find, as a programmer, it's very hard for me to sort of think bottom up and to think about how I could design things without sort of this big overarching global view. And so I liked your comment just because that gives me something to chew on.
Yeah.
To switch topics a little bit, I'm wondering how you feel about pair programming. What do you like about it?
Yeah, I really love pair programming. There's definitely a time and a place for it, and that's not all the time, but I find it as like a really great tool for improving code quality and clarity and for learning. Collaborating with people on a project is a really amazing way to learn. You get to see how they work, and you get to be more introspective about how you work. And you kind of like take your two methods and you kind of put them into a dialogue together, and you have this whole new thing. And for whatever reason, in my experience at least, like the code quality goes up significantly when I work in that way. And and it's also just really fun to do. So I do it at work, you know, quite a lot. And I do it in my free time on side projects whenever I'm able to. One project that I'm working on lately is with my friend Assad mainly, but a few other people have been involved as well. And we've been building like a sort of library for constructing chatbots, which currently they only run on the Matrix protocol, but the architecture is such that they can be interpreted in arbitrary like chat protocols. And it's a pretty cool design. It's kind of under the hood. It's secretly like a bit like the bots are Mealy machines, and there's all these really cool tricks for composing them in different ways to sort of extend the behaviors and combine the behaviors together. And I find it to be like a really kind of beautiful design.
What's one of the coolest things you learned from pair programming, or maybe the most interesting?
I mean, I guess like it's probably not the most exciting, but like basically just sort of being exposed to different people's processes of like thinking through a problem and how to like solve it, and then how to iterate on it, because everyone has some subtle variation on how they do that. And by pairing with people, you know, especially people who have like radically different views of programming from me, it gives me the opportunity to sort of like get out of my own way of thinking about it, and to sort of like enforces me to sort of like reconcile my view with their view. And in the process, you know, you get like the end product, which is like the software, but like that's kind of like a byproduct of like the sort of learning process of working with someone else.
I think that's beautiful that the software is the byproduct of pair programming. Can you be a little more specific about like something in particular you've learned from pair programming? Maybe to say like working with Assad on this chatbot. Is there any specific techniques or ways of thinking that you've extracted from him?
Yeah, definitely. So like with the chatbot, it was pretty cool. Like we started out just sort of thinking in like the sort of like most basic way possible about what does it mean to be a chatbot? And I mean, I guess, you know, in some sense we were doing like kind of like a denotational design thing, but I don't think it was like very formally that. But and so basically we kind of outlined this sort of like very sort of like boring set of like functions that represent like the operations that you would need in order to like have this sort of dialogue that a chatbot represents. And then from that, we then take these functions and then sort of like look at them and say, okay, so how can we what is this? Can we do we really need these separate functions or are these sort of aspects of the same sort of like subroutine? And can we sort of like compute inline these things two together into something else? And then we did that. And then suddenly it's like, oh wow, so this thing actually looks pretty interesting. It looks like these other structures that we've seen before in other places. And then it's like, let's see if we can generalize this further and just like make it more polymorphic now. And so we start pulling out all the sort of concrete types and replacing them with type parameters. And then suddenly it's like, oh wow, this thing looks really familiar. Let's see what kinds of type classes we can apply to this thing and if we can create like sort of lawful instances with. And suddenly it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It's a profunctor and it's like a strong profunctor and it's a choice profunctor.
You said profunctor? What is that?
In Haskell, at least, a profunctor essentially is a generalization of a functor where you have this operation called dymap, which allows you to sort of do composition before and after the function that you're dymapping over. And the fact that our like sort of bot interface or our bot type is a profunctor means that we can sort of describe a bot that takes some input like text and gives you some output like list of text, and then we can dymap over that and essentially embed that input and that output into a larger input and a larger output, like, you know, so that means you've got some type that represents like the matrix protocol input and the matrix protocol's output, and then you write a bot that's like operating on say text as input and list of text as output. Well, then you can dymap to sort of like convert the input, the matrix input, to like the text input and the text output to the matrix output, which essentially means that you've like lifted, so to speak, your bot from text to like matrix operations.
Another way of thinking about that is maybe that you've sort of simplified the problem of writing a matrix bot down to writing a text bot.
Yes, exactly. So you've factored out everything that you don't care about, which is like the matrix protocol, and you are just defining your bot in terms of like it's like the bare minimum of what it needs as input and what it wants to give as output. And then you sort of define a way to sort of like lift that into the whatever other context you want to put it in. And this means that you can define a bot that just operates on these like on text or whatever types it is. And then you can have all these different ways of sort of dymapping it into different protocols. And so you can write a subroutine for a bot once and then be like, okay, now I want to run it on Matrix. Now I want to run it on IRC. Now I want to run it on Discord. Now I want to run it on GitHub or something, on a GitHub bot.
It's interesting to think about GitHub as a chat platform, which I guess it is sort of through the comment system and the PRs. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, normally people think about like chatbots as like things for like chat protocols like IRC or Discord or whatever. But I think there's a lot more things that can be described as like chatbot type situations as well. I don't know what the right word for that is, but like, for example, yeah, GitHub is an interesting example. Also, there's like, you know, like maybe like even like a telephone system, like you could have some sort of bot interface for like, you know, doing text to voice and like communicating over the phone. there's like all kinds of opportunities for doing these sort of, it's basically anything that is dialogue driven. I mean, like another way to say it is that like a chatbot is like inherently co-algebraic, but we don't really need to, I don't really want to get to the details of what that means because I'm not an expert on it.
That's fair. Okay. I was just about to ask. So am I correct in thinking that the idea here was originally to write a matrix bot, and then you sort of went through this denotative system, and what came out was something significantly more general? And did you get the idea to write more bots, like a GitHub bot, from the denotation that turned out, or did you come into the project thinking it would be nice to write a generalized system?
I didn't realize how general we were going to be able to make it. I think Assad had an idea because he had been studying coalgebras and state machines and stuff like that a lot recently. And I think he had kind of like a sort of ulterior motive in like leading me down this path. But the initial idea was simply to make a chatbot for the Matrix protocol. And then as soon as it was obvious to us that it was like, it could be a lot more general than that, just all of these different ideas kind of flooded in. And we like, it immediately became obvious that there was like all of these different cool features that we could add. And it was like every different type class that we were like noticed that we could use. Suddenly it was like, oh wow, there's like another cool thing that we could do with this feature. And I mean, to the point where I almost think I could have like a startup based on this, but like, I don't think I have in me to be the founder of a tech company, but like, I think there's a lot of really interesting use cases. I have this sort of fantasy of like, one other instance that our chatbot meets is like, it's a strong perfunctory, but it's also a category. So that means that you can have like an identity bot that just gives, that receives an input and returns the same input out essentially. And then you have like a bot composition, which means that you can like pipe the output of one bot into the input of another bot. And I haven't really played around with this yet. And I'm not really sure how it would work because of the way we're doing like the different protocols. Like there's some big changes we'd have to make, but in principle, there ought to be a way to sort of have bots in dialogue. So you could have like your matrix bot that then pipes its output to the input of like the GitHub bot, which then pipes its output to like the telephone bot or something, in such a way where you can like, you're performing like your sort of protocol specific effects along that whole chain of bots, so that you could like do something like, and this is like my fantasy, is to like have a matrix bot where you send it a message telling it to like merge PR number 73, and then the matrix bot then tells the GitHub bot, merge PR number 73, please. And then the GitHub bot like merges PR number 73, and then it tells the telephone bot like, PR number 73 was merged. Order a pizza to this address to celebrate. And then it like orders a pizza to your house.
I love that. Do you imagine that as all like one bot that's piped together, or is that separate bots running in different places with the same library?
Yeah, so this is a good question. And this is what I was kind of hinting at when I said that there would be some big changes that would have to happen. Even though we have the category instance right now, but the way that the bots are sort of interpreted into the protocols doesn't really allow for what I just described. And so like at the moment, I think if like it would probably have to involve like different bots that were like in, that are like different sort of like actual like binaries that are like sending messages over the wire to one another, which is wouldn't even be using the category instance and would not really be the cool way to do it. I mean, it's maybe the more practical way, but like basically I think this is kind of hard to talk about without like just like looking at the code and stuff, but like we would have to change the way that we sort of do the protocol type interpretations. Because basically, like right now, you write a bot on some input and some output, and it's also parameterized by a state, so some state as well. And then you can like quote like lift it into the matrix protocol, but then you have to then take that matrix bot and you have to like you have to like use that bot in like a matrix and like interpreter, which is just like something that lives in IO and just like actually does like the calls to the matrix API. Yeah. And so I think in order to like do what I was describing, we would have to like move that interpreter inside of one of the bots instead of having it be like this external thing that you run a bot inside of. And then, but then if we did that, and I'm not sure exactly how that would work, I'm being really vague here, but if we did that, then I think you could then have like all these bots that are sort of in memory together, composed together, and they're each like handling their own interpretation and they can send messages to one another at the same time.
Sounds like you might have reinvented actors there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about, but it's in Haskell and it's typed, and that makes it more confusing to figure out.
And it's got a category instance, so it's significantly better.
Maybe. I mean, it depends who you ask.
Earlier you said that you're stuck in a utopian fantasy about people living together and working together. And I'm wondering, what exactly did you mean by that? And maybe even, what does utopia mean to you?
I'm pretty confident that you could go to anyone, no matter how much you disagree with them in general, and you can read their like critique of like their like analysis of whatever is currently going on in the world, and you can agree at least to a certain extent that, you know, that they're right about what's wrong, whether or not you agree with their larger ideology is like irrelevant. Like, I mean, and I think that's the case because the analysis is like the easy part. It's like really easy to see all the problems in the world today. And like, we're all sort of like aware to one extent or another. Maybe we don't all agree about everything, but you know, it's gotten to a pretty obvious place. But then when it comes to sort of like prescribing any kind of solution, that's where you kind of run up against a wall. And like, personally, I don't think I've ever like encountered someone's like theory or whatever, the political theory or philosophical theory or whatever, and been like, oh my God, this is like the perfect solution. And if we executed this, then like the world would be like perfect. Like, in fact, it's kind of the opposite, where like pretty much everyone who's prescribing a solution, it seems like a terrible idea. And it seems like historically that's been the case as well. And so I'm not going to try to come out and be another person who prescribes some sort of like idea of like what the world should be or how to get there. But for me, at least, like instead of like trying to sort of like strive towards some sort of like utopian fantasy for like the world, it's really hard because you have to balance it out. Like, you don't want to be like totally like caught up in your own world and like not sort of like aware of your impact on things around you, and you don't want to be like totally solipsistic in that way, however you say that word. But it's also like, you know, there's no easy solution for like the larger problems in the world. So you have to sort of find some way to sort of like engage with the world in a way that is ethical and meaningful and like allows you to sort of like relate to other people and like be empathic towards other people. And also like, but also like sort of be able to like live your life. And like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm not answering the question, but,
it's okay. It's still interesting.
Thanks. As far as like the sort of what I said before about having some kind of like utopian fantasy about like collaborating and living with people or something, it's like, I don't mean like a commune or something, but like, I just mean to say that like, I think the way that we organize our society is not very good. You know, like I just said, the analysis is pretty obvious, but like, you know, we like, there's a lot of waste. There's a lot of like, there's a huge amount of waste. And basically once you're like not able to be like a sort of quote productive member of the society for whatever reason, be it like age or mental illness or whatever, you're essentially like cast aside. And like, that doesn't really make sense to me. Like, I think that we should find a way to sort of like live in the world in a way that's sort of like aware and empathic of everyone's needs and abilities and sort of like, and I don't know what the solution is, because obviously, or maybe not obvious to everyone, but like from what I see of like examples of like trying to sort of implement like top down, like communist style, like situations in different countries, that doesn't seem like it ends well. There's always this sort of power dynamic that like sort of like ends up being more influential than whatever political ideology you put in place. And so I don't think that that's really a solution. And like, but I mean, if, and then if you go the other extreme and you're like, oh, well, there should just be like no rules, like that, you know, I kind of like that idea too. But then you sort of like just open up the space for people to take advantage and sort of like do whatever they want, and which could be like really horrific.
But it sounds like in your radio station example, you sort of got the structure right and you didn't need rules.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of true. And I mean, that did happen. That's a real thing. But I think it has to do with like the scale of the operation as well. If you're able to know everybody that's involved and it's able to actually be a community of like fellows who like are empathic to one another, and like you can kind of like know what's going on, and like there's like you can see who's responsible for what, then I think there's like a lot more accountability, and like things like that can just work. But then when you try to like think about like a larger society, like, you know, the United States is like hundreds of millions of people, it's like you're never going to be able to sort of have that kind of relationship with everyone. So I don't really know what kind of solution you could have on that scale. I guess like maybe the goal is to not really try to solve it on that scale, but to try to solve it on your local scale. So like, you know, developing relationships with your neighbors and with like the people around you and your coworkers and like, you know, the people at your coffee shop, and like, you know, it's kind of silly, but I mean, if everyone sort of like really tried to do things like that, then, you know, that could actually, that could have a meaningful impact on your local scale. Like, I don't really know where it can go from there, but like, I mean, that's really a good starting point, at least. It's all I can really think to do.
In some sense, sort of everything is local, right? I had the same experience when I lived in Denver, which was I hated the city and just found it was really unfriendly. And then I set a goal for myself to just go meet everybody in the neighborhood. And seemingly overnight, like what felt like a really awful place to live, I was really sad to be leaving, because just everywhere I went, I ran into 10 people I knew and liked.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's sort of is that maybe what you mean by utopia? Sorry to ask you the leading questions here.
I mean, I guess it could be. I mean, okay, so here's like, this is not utopia, but here's like an idea of like something that could improve things. Like, or let me describe a problem first, and then I'll describe how I think it could be solved. I have a good friend of mine whose mother passed away last year. She was in like an elder care facility. She was like no one from her family was able to be there when she died, and because of like the COVID restrictions, she was actually been like really struggling with being in this elder care facility, and was like really unhappy there, and like was really intensely depressed for a long time since she was there. And at least it's like she's able to move on from that. And you know, this is pretty dark, but like my point of bringing it up is that's like what we do with people when they aren't able to like afford to be a productive part of our society anymore. We just put them in a box somewhere, and if they're able to afford it, I mean, even to like be in an elderly care facility is extremely expensive. And like if you had a society that was like more focused on like multi-generational family relationships and community relationships, then maybe it wouldn't have to be like that. Like, you know, maybe like the person, you know, your neighbor down the street who's like 85 years old and is like struggling to like take care of themselves doesn't have to go to some elder care facility if we're not all just completely isolated in these boxes that we live in. And instead we're like, you know, we check on each other, we help each other out, we like do basic things. Maybe like, I don't know. I mean, it's like things like that, I think, that would like could lead to sort of maybe some concept of like a local utopia or something. I don't know if that's even the right word anymore.
It sounds like you're sort of doing your part on that sense, because we talk quite often offline, and one of the things you've been talking about is setting up a residency program. I was wondering if you could tell me about that.
Yeah, well, this is like another fantasy of mine that I think I want to try to execute in the next couple of years, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. I live in, like, in Los Angeles, and like kind of outside of the city a little bit in the valley, and I'm super lucky, super blessed to be able to like have this situation, but I have like a, you know, like a nice home, and I have like a barn at the back of my house. And in the barn, I have, I have like all the tools from my old business when I used to be a carpenter. So I've got kind of like a little wood shop set up in there. I've been sort of putting that back together and cleaning things up and making it into like kind of like a nice space. So basically what I'm saying is I've got like this space that I have set up for all these different kinds of like fabrication and other sort of like projects, that fabrication shops and like other kinds of like electronics shop. And I know tons of people who are like into these different sort of like subgenres of, you know, interest, and like it's really fun, and like I really love having this space. I'm like incredibly lucky to be able to do these things. And I just started to think the other day, well, this was like a few months ago, but I started to think about how it would be so cool if I could sort of make this not just about like me and my little side projects, and instead kind of like make it a space where like I could invite in other people who have like really specific goals, and I can like collaborate with them in a kind of like one-on-one way, perhaps, I'm not really sure, but to sort of like achieve some sort of like prototype or version of like this thing that they want to do. So I called my friend Mark Chang, who's like one of my favorite people in the world. He's like a freelance electrical engineer. And basically his job is that when your company has some like big like engineering project and your RF or whatever electrical engineers are completely blocked by some technical issue, they call somebody who calls somebody who calls somebody who calls Mark Chang, and then they fly him out and he fixes your problem for you. He's like a hitman. And like he's like one of the smartest people I've ever met. But anyway, so I called him and I told him about this idea, and he was like, oh, that's so cool. There's so many projects I could think of that I would love to collaborate with you on. I would love to come out there and do that. And then I started asking a few other people, and I was like, oh, like if you like had this space and you could do these things, is there something you'd want to do? Just kind of like what I said with the radio station, where I just started telling people about it and just seeing how they responded and then adjusting the idea based on that. And I've just like had like a number of people be like really excited about it and like kind of like give me different suggestions about what to do and how to do it. And so I think I want to do it. I think I want to sort of do some kind of like open call thing where I mean, I'm essentially talking about a variation on like an art residency, I guess, but I don't want it to be strictly about art, and it doesn't have to be anything specific. I want it to be like really open-ended. Like you have this like really big idea that you want to do, and you're not going to like execute the whole thing here or with me, but like maybe you can sort of carve out some sort of like smaller prototype version of it or some aspect of it that you want to like work on for like a month or 2 months or however long it is. And it's something that I either have like the facilities for, or I have the space for, and you have the tools to bring, or whatever it is, then we can do it. Like maybe as like a once a summer thing with someone. And there's a huge amount of details that I haven't figured out, but like that's the sort of basic idea.
I know that people are going to ask, so if someone wanted to apply, how should they go about doing that?
I guess if you have... I don't know. Is there some way to like contact you or anyone via the way that this podcast is distributed?
Yeah, we can just put your email or something if you want.
Well, maybe we'll put some kind of email address that you can send emails to, but you have to be forewarned that this is in such like a vague state that like you may not get a response from me for a long time, and the final sort of structure of this may not be what I just described.
I think that's fair enough. I'm wondering, what are some abstractions that help you make sense of the world? For example, like, does your understanding of functional programming ever bleed out into the world in sort of unexpected domains? What about things like economics or biology or religion or sort of anything like that? What tools do you have for making sense of the world?
So I went to college for this new media program called Technocultural Studies, which was something like looking at our relationship to technology as individuals and culture. And then I got into studying art history through that. I wanted to learn more about like sort of backdrop to like multimedia stuff. And so I started taking art history classes, and I started sort of like getting like caught up in like the sort of like the narrative of art history as this sort of like it's almost like this like manifest destiny for like art, where it's like this sort of like, I mean, well, it's not, it, I mean, but I mean, like if you're like in your first like course of art history, you get the impression of that in like the very intro classes. And then like they immediately like dispel that, and you're like, they're like, actually, it's not even remotely that, like, don't think that, it's wrong, it's bad. But like, you kind of like get caught up on this idea of this sort of like progression and like things improving, and then that completely gets torn down and falls apart like almost immediately. And then I was like, oh, well, like, this is really cool, but like, I also kind of want to understand how things work and why things work. And so I started taking philosophy classes, and then you kind of like have like the same experience again, where it's like you take a class on like whatever, like early modern Phil or whatever it is, and they're like, and now we're on like Berkeley, and like this is like idealism. Then you're like, oh wow, that makes so much sense. And then like by the end of like the section, they're like, and then this is like the critical flaw with Berkeley, and this is why it doesn't work. And then you're like, oh, so like that was cool, but like in terms of like learning how to learn, but in terms of actually learning about the world, it's kind of didn't really get me anywhere. And then it's just that over and over and over again. And like, when, where it's like to the point where you can like, you can take these like, I don't know, I took this like Kant class with like a really like famous Kant scholar, and we spent the whole course on like the Critique of Pure Reason, building it up, building it up, building it up. And it was like this like beautiful fucking idea. And then it was like the last week of the class, and we get to like, or maybe not the last week, but it was towards the end of it, and we get to like, it's like, and now for like the like Kant's like piece de resistance, and like the sort of like the proof that for the whole thing, which is like this like transcendental deduction thing. And like, I cannot even remotely explain the details of this because it's been so long, and I'm probably just don't think I know what I'm talking about here. But like, but the point is just that like the professor literally like pointed out like one paragraph, maybe even like one sentence, where the entire book just completely fell apart. And it's not like you could just change that, because that whole, that like statement that where it falls apart is like completely dependent on everything leading up to it, and then everything coming down from it. It's like, you, it is sort of like, it's, that's where the problem is, but that is like a result of the entire structure, and you cannot change that without changing the entire structure. And so suddenly you're like, oh my God, this thing was like so perfect for so long. And then you get to like the pinnacle and like the final proof. And then suddenly it's like, oh wait, this is like broken. And that was kind of like a really frustrating moment for me. Not that I was like, I think I probably already knew at the time that it wasn't like Kant's not the end all be all of philosophy, but like, it's just like more, it's just like so much churn. And it's just like, I don't know, at this point, I after that, I kind of moved on to sort of trying to sort of understand math, but I found it really unapproachable. And then I kind of found a way to sort of approach math through programming, eventually through functional programming, that like kind of opened it up for me. But I learned there that like the secret to like being able to make like strong statements about anything is to sort of highly constrain your domain, and to the point where like you may not be making statements about anything at all, or like anything, like, yeah, it's like only this internally consistent system that you really talk about. And that's also like the secret to functional programming in a lot of ways too, I think. But so to speak to like what like my worldviews are and things like that, I mean, I just don't even know anymore. I've kind of given up a little bit on trying to sort of like have this sort of like macro view of like, this is why things are the way they are.
You said you sort of given up on trying to figure out everything in your worldview. And I'm really interested in that in particular, because something, it's like so much about being a Haskell programmer in particular, like the technique is where you really just need to understand the problem at such a deep level that things have to be that way. right? There really isn't any other way for them to be. And I'm so curious as to, like, how do you not just carry that same assiduousness with you in your epistemology? How do you not approach the world in the same way you approach a Haskell program?
I don't really see the conflict in the same way that you do. In Haskell, you don't just have like a complete structured formalization of the entire world of computer programs. Like the sort of the inherent power of Haskell comes from constraining the world to like a subset. You know, like if all Haskell programs were operating in unconstrained I/O, then you would not be able to reason about them. And if Haskell, and even then, it's like that's still more constrained than like, you know, the whole world of computer programs. Like, it's like, you know, so I think you can, when you can take that same view to your experience of life as well, where you can say like, I can't solve problems in like the general case, but I can sort of constrain the domain of this issue or whatever, this problem, and to in such a way that I can sort of start to model it and think about it and find solutions that work within this particular context. And because everything is contextual, so I mean, I think that's kind of the same thing as what you do when you start like introducing a type system and introducing like annotations on effects in the type system through like monads or whatever it is that you're doing. Like, you're constraining the domain so that you can actually talk about it.
I've got two more questions for you. Did you ever encounter the Curry-Howard isomorphism in between philosophy and math? And if so, what does it mean, both sort of to the world and to you personally?
I almost mentioned it like a minute ago when I was saying that I found math really unapproachable. And then through computer science and programming, I found a way to approach it. And I always really loved math and thought it was like this really beautiful, amazing thing that people do that is so cool and unique, but I just found it totally unapproachable. I had a really hard time with it in school. I mean, I had a really hard time in school in general. That's another thing I didn't mention, but like, I was like a terrible student in school. And then, well, in like grade school, and like, I had like, at best, I had a C average. And then in college, I got into one college, and just by total luck, I think. And then I eventually ended up dropping out just because I had a really hard time, kind of like for various reasons. But like, I was either like really crushing it and like getting like A's in all my classes, or I was like failing everything and like dropping out of the semester. It was like, I was a really inconsistent student. But I loved the idea of math, and I found it totally unapproachable, and I didn't know how to engage with it. And then on the other hand, I was like pretty like comfortable with like, you know, like at least like certain parts of philosophy and like analytic philosophy and understanding that stuff. And I was always really good at computers. And it's like a kid, I went to computer camp and stuff. And I was like, I like had like sort of like a reasonable understanding of how they worked and like programming and like, and then when I sort of started to get more interested in programming kind of in my, you know, in my more recent life, like I guess in my like early 30s or something, I remember like I was learning about like Python and JavaScript and all this stuff. And then I learned about functional programming, and I was like, oh, what's that? And I started like clicking around on Wikipedia. And like, I remember like one night I was like just clicking around on links on Wikipedia, and I like landed on the page for the Curry-Howard isomorphism, and I was just like, what the hell is this thing? And like, I didn't really understand any of the jargon or like what it really meant. But all I saw was that like these people had like some sort of like formal proof that math, computer science, and philosophy are the same thing. And I mean, obviously there's like, it's like constrained subsets of each of those things. And it's not like, there's a lot of caveats to that statement. You know, it's like, there's like an isomorphism, it's a mapping between. So they're not equal, but they're a type of equality. But like, but anyways, I just saw that there was like, oh my God, these three things that I've always been interested in, two of which I kind of have an okay understanding of, and one of which I find unapproachable, are like technically the same thing. and like in some sense at least the same thing. And that was like very like mind-blowing for me. And it was suddenly like, wow, is this like, it was also like, maybe there's like a way to like sneak in the back door to understanding math through this thing. And so I became like, that was really what got me like super kind of obsessed with learning Haskell and functional programming. And I still don't really understand the Curry Howard isomorphism. I mean, I understand it. I understand aspects of it, but I still struggle with category theory and like a lot of math stuff, but like it's definitely been like a way to sort of approach math in a way that is more accessible to me. And it really kind of like changed my view. Like it, the math that's out there for you to learn today is like not the math that you remember from grade school.
I'm always, I think it's so funny how non-math people always to like, they just assume math is about numbers because it's what they did in grade school. And it's like, it's just so frustrating about how much like really cool structure about the universe, about like reality itself that they seem to be missing.
Yeah, I agree. Like I encounter that a lot with people where they say like, oh, I'm not good at math. I don't understand math. I'm never going to learn math. I can't calculate good. I'm not good at memorizing things. But like, I mean, well, there's many different kinds of math, but like, at least like when you enter into like this sort of subset of like the sort of math, this kind of abstract area of it, it's really all about understanding structures and like what, and the properties of structures. And then you get all that calculation, all that stuff kind of like falls out of that for free in a sense. But like, I mean, I think if people were sort of like taught math in a different way and more like, from a more foundational level, then I think a lot of people would find it a lot more approachable.
Yeah, I think so too. Thanks for that. One final question. If you could make one piece of advice more broadly known to the world and sort of like snap your fingers and just change people's lives, what piece of advice would you give? What sort of thing do you expect to have the most value to our listeners?
You don't have to do things the way people tell you to do them. You don't have to like engage with dialogues on the terms that are presented to you if you choose not to. And like, if you can change like the terms of the dialogue, then you can like change the potential outcomes. One thing that's really powerful, or like one really powerful tool that I think more people could take advantage of, is just that like, things are, you know, in our society and in our relationships and with each other and in our, with our jobs and with our, with everything, it's really like, we sometimes forget that like there's a dialogue that's we're engaging with, and the terms of that dialogue are totally negotiable, and we can change them, and we have agency in that relationship, whatever that relationship is. And even if it's with your boss and your boss is like the more powerful person in that relationship, they are also dependent on you in order to even have this dialogue. And so you have a part that you can play in that dialogue and in shaping it. And it doesn't, and if you can change the terms of the dialogue, you can change the terms of the result of the dialogue.
I love that. Thank you so much for being here, Solomon.
Yeah. Thank you, Sandy.